Hello again and welcome to another episode of Voices from SA. My name is Nicholas Claude. I hope you're keeping well, keeping healthy, taking all necessary precautions against contracting coronavirus. Wash your hands regularly, keep your distance from people. If you're in South Africa, well, I'm talking to you on Wednesday now, the 25th of March. Thursday midnight, tomorrow midnight, we go into a 21-day lockdown, which is an effort by the South African government to at least lower the curve of the pandemic in South Africa. I'm struck, though, sort of by the lack of a global collective response. I don't know, the United Nations, G20, I mean, whatever your politics, World Bank and IMF, these are significant institutions. We should be getting guidance on, you know, best practice in terms of how to confront the virus now, confront the medical impact, and also, you know, the global economic fallout. I don't know, I'm just, it's a little concerning, I have to say. Maybe it's just a reflection of the world we live in. But please take care, be safe wherever you are. I'm obviously now adjusting my process to an online reality, if I can put it that way. So I'll be recording remotely now. From tomorrow, I'm hoping the flow of episodes will not be too disrupted by any technological hassles. I have the Hindenburg set up to record via Skype, and I'm hoping there won't be any glitches, and that'll be, at least for the next few episodes, that'll be the way I operate. But who knows how we will be in 21 days. Remember to please support Voices from SA by becoming a patron. You may go to www.patreon.com/voicesfromsa. Help Voices from SA keep telling the stories that inform and inspire. My guest this week, talk about inspirational. My guest this week is Dr. Jackie King. She's an aquatic ecologist specializing in freshwater, that is to say riverine inland water systems. Jackie is a pioneer in her field and is the winner of the prestigious 2019 Stockholm Water Prize. Back in the early 80s when she embarked on her research career, it was her and some of her colleagues at the time developed a whole new field of study, actually, that today is called environmental flows. In essence, this is a set of concepts and methods that provide stakeholders, communities, and governments with a set of scenarios, sort of objective research, I suppose, when they plan the future of a river system. She describes herself as an objective researcher, providing stakeholders the tools to make reasoned decisions. We chatted around the need for balance between soft and hard engineering. We talk about rivers, the Mekong, for example, and river systems, the Okavango Delta, and some of their incredible characteristics. I referred to the Okavango as a swamp, but as I learned, it's much more majestic than that. While she does not describe herself as an activist, it is clear she is revered by many around the world for her efforts to harmonize the relationship between humans and the rivers that are so important to life on Earth. So please now enjoy my chat with Jackie. Jackie, thanks for your time this morning. I appreciate it. As I've been saying, you know, it's not often I have a chance to get out of Johannesburg, where I feel kind of quite constricted in my guest list. And so as soon as I move out of Johannesburg, I try and look for interesting people to speak to. And it was actually last year that I read up about you and you winning the Stockholm Water Prize for 2019, and congratulations on that. You are an aquatic ecologist. Could you give us some idea of what that is?
Yes, more specifically, I'm a freshwater ecologist because, of course, a marine biologist could also be an aquatic ecologist. So I focus on inland waters, fresh waters. I studied at the University of Cape Town, got a BSc with botany and zoology as majors, and then I did a PhD in freshwater ecology. And from then on, you can disperse in many different ways with your work. You could specialize in geomorphology, water chemistry, river plants, algae, otters, whatever you like, the same as you would in the sea.
On riverine systems.
Yes, on riverine systems. So I, when I was studying, I was already married with a stepdaughter, and then I had two small children born while I was doing my PhD. And so once I finished my PhD in 1982, I couldn't go straight into a job. So I stepped back for 10 years to look after my two small children. Wow. And at the same time, I applied for research money to research the hours in a day when they were perhaps in a creche or a playgroup. And I gradually increased my research hours as they got older until by the time the youngest was 10 and I was 46, I then started to practice as a scientist for the first time.
My goodness. My mum had a... I suppose it's not an unusual story from that kind of era. I think she was also, you know, three kids, and then only when she was a little bit younger than you, but also I suppose it would have been about a 10-year period from her having the first child to sort of starting out on her, I think she only started to her degree like in her early 30s or something like that, or at least certainly her postgraduate studies. So... What sort of drew you? Did you grow up on a river that had enchanted you as a child? Or?
No, nothing at all. It was a bit more practical, really. My husband was working here as an engineer, but I couldn't guarantee that we were always going to live by the sea. And so with three small children to look after and a husband whose engineering job could take him somewhere else, I had to go for something other than the marine side of studies, which was what UCT was most focused on, obviously being inside the sea. And so I launched myself off into the unknown on freshwater without a supervisor or without anybody with that expertise in the department at the university, and literally had to wing it on my own. But in a way, those years of being a part-time and gradually a fuller-time researcher were the making of a career that came afterwards.
Yes.
Because it gave me the freedom to follow where I wanted to go. It gave me the freedom to follow my curiosity. And not complete freedom, of course. I had to find the money. There was no paid job here. I've never had a salaried post in my whole research career, in my whole scientific career. I've always lived on soft money, having to find money myself, pay it into the university, and then getting it paid out to me as a salary. And the day I stopped attracting money was the day I would stop having a job. Whoa. So it was tough, but also it allowed me to follow what I wanted to do. And eventually when I retired from UCT, I started my own consultancy and just carried on working around the world.
One of the main challenges of being a researcher, sort of around the world, this constant battle to fund work, or does it very much depend on the kind of research you're doing? I suppose some of it's sexy and attractive and some of it isn't.
When I first was doing part-time research, we were getting money from an organization called the Foundation for Research Development, which was a part of CSIR, Council for Scientific and Industrial Research. And they, after a few years into my research, they decided to focus more on funding emerging scientists rather than established scientists, which I was by then. And so I had to look for other forms of funding, and I turned to an organization called the South African Water Research Commission. This had been created in, I think, the 1960s or 70s after a very bad drought in South Africa. And it now takes a levy from all bulk water sales in the country, paid into the Water Research Commission, and then that money goes out to water research across the whole scale, everything from cloud seeding to water treatment plants to the social use of water. So I applied for them, and because they were there to address South Africa's problems and water needs, I had to look for more management-orientated research rather than straight blue-sky research. And that is when I started to look for what would be the kind of research that might attract them. And I put in two proposals. One was for something called the assimilative capacity of rivers for pollutants. How much water could you put, how much effluence could you put into
them? Put in before things.
Yeah. And the other one was this very new field, which didn't even have a name then, which was essentially how much water, not what quality water, but how much quantity of water does a river need in order to survive? How much can we take away from it? How much must we leave there?
That's cool.
And I went, I put those two proposals in, and they went for the water quantity one, which was an enormous act of faith on their part, because we as a country didn't know what we were talking about. I didn't know what we were talking about. And in fact, the whole world didn't know what we were talking about, because the problems emerging from a decades and decades of dam building were just starting to emerge. Rivers were dying.
Is that the genesis of what we now call environmental flows?
Yes, it is.
So this is the sort of area of research that you and and some of your colleagues have sort of founded.
Made our own, yes. There were a few other people in the world who were going along that same track as me, and that would be in the sort of late 1970s or early 1980s. But the difference between me and them, and so there was a handful in America, one or two in Australia, one in New Zealand, a couple in Norway, so on. The difference between us and them, or me and them at that stage, was that we were in a developing country. And so the whole picture of dying rivers and the impact it was having on people was much clearer here than in countries where people have salaries and jobs and just like to have nice rivers for recreation or something. So we forged ahead in a completely different direction than the other countries, bringing all the ecological and social stuff together into one big research and concept and method development package.
It seems to me, though, as these were the first efforts at sort of trying to grasp the environmental impact of humans on nature, looking at rivers. If you're talking about, you know, how much pollution can we put in the river on the one hand, or how much can we extract for irrigation or use on the other, that those are the two sort of, I suppose, major human impacts on rivers in general.
Yes, if you look back at what was happening in the whole science of ecology and ecosystems then, up to about the 1970s, people were focusing on saving species. You know, we knew things were going wrong in the world, and people were trying to save the condor or the panda or the this or the that. And about that time, the shift was happening from species to ecosystems. We were starting to realize that you couldn't save species if they weren't in an ecosystem that they could survive in. So you had to look after their home, their habitats.
Yes. And so you couldn't isolate the two.
You can't. No. You can't isolate it. And so it was really that very early beginning of looking after whole ecosystems. And it was terribly difficult. I mean, for rivers, the work we were trying to do, the Water Research Commission tasked me to go out and find out what was going wrong in the world in terms of dying rivers, and then come back and recommend what South Africa should do. We were really launching ourselves into the unknown.
But I suppose in a weird...
No textbooks, no recipes.
You're making it
not all... even a name for the discipline that we were about to help
create. It's absolutely amazing.
Yes.
And kind of weird in a way, if you consider, I suppose, you know, we're at the height of apartheid. South Africa's kind of isolated from the world, sort of politically, and I imagine also academically as well, scientifically. And yet there's this kind of root of research that is going to become so significant. So you were you were somehow given the space, or there was some awareness within this regime of a relationship with nature and human.
It was strange. I'm still trying to quite figure out exactly why it happened, because it was it was enormous what happened. You know, it was the government having faith in me, a sort of a middle-aged woman who had no real track record, keeping faith with me over the years when I occasionally dropped a few tears because I didn't understand it. Me launching myself out into a world of engineers and water managers and trying to understand them and what they were doing, trying to find a common language with them. And all of us, the Department of Water Affairs, coming on board, because soon after I started that work, they phoned me and said they were planning to dam a river. It was actually the Lephalala River. And they asked me how much water they should leave in the river. They'd heard about these this new thinking. And I said, well, what kind of river do you want? And they said, what do you mean? And I said, well, the more water you take and the more you change the pattern of flow of the rivers, the more the river will change. Mm. It's like us taking away 80% of your diet. And the bit that we leave for you is just porridge every day with nothing else. That's what we're doing to rivers. We're taking away their variability and then expecting them to carry on, but they can't. So what kind of river do you want? And they said, we don't know. We'll have to work on this. Mm. And we started to work on it and gradually realized it wasn't a decision of scientists to recommend what that river should be like. It was a decision of society, what they wanted their rivers to be like. They had to be able to negotiate with their governments. And so we moved, during our development of our concepts and methods, we moved into what we called a scenario-based approach, where we would build up pictures of possible futures in a way that society could understand. We'd make it accessible to them in terms of language. And then they had the power, the government and the stakeholders, to work for the rivers, to decide on what they wanted. And so we ended up with something quite different to, say, Europe, which had a European framework directive, which essentially said that all rivers must meet good ecological standards. We went a different route because we were in isolation much in those days, where we envisaged a mosaic of river conditions across the whole country, some being held in high condition with most of their water intact, perhaps because they fed a conservation area like Kruger Park, and some held in a lower condition because the priority might there be to grow food and you'd want more water for irrigation.
Yeah.
And that's what we've been trying to do. Mm. We put the... It took us about 30 years to put the concepts in and methods in place and get them used. And now we're into a much, much, much more difficult phase, which is called implementation.
Yeah.
That's where you bring in society and negotiation and politics and industry and vested interests and poor capacity and lots of other things come in.
Yeah.
So it's not, we're not leading into an ideal future. We're going to struggle to get there. Mm. But at least now we have the scientific understanding to do it.
One of the first projects you mentioned working on was the Lesotho Highlands water scheme. And indeed, one of the sort of significant legislative components that came out of that, if I understand it correctly, is, well, there was at least an understanding that whatever took place upstream was going to impact people further downstream, and they would need to be compensated in some way for that. And that has become some kind of global blueprint for dealing with these kind of projects, or is it a specifically...
Yes, to begin
and
with.
And how do you even compensate? You know, how do you even sort of judge that compensation? How do you
the understanding wasn't there when we started this work. It was our first international work. And
this is in the late 70s or early 80s?
No, it wasn't. It was in the mid-1990s.
Oh, wow, okay. More recent
and,
than I thought.
And Catsey Dam had been built, and there was an international outcry about the lack of water being released from that dam. It had been designed with very little downstream release of water. Hmm. So we, by then, through our work in South Africa, understood that there not only were there people involved as well as river systems that would be affected, but we were also showing quite clearly that it wasn't just the people upstream of the dam wall whose land had been drowned by the reservoir, which is what normally was seen as the impact
compensation
on people.
Yeah
but we were able to show that that impact continued right down the river downstream of the dam because of the way the river itself had been
was going to change.
So you had 100% impact upstream for relatively few people, a lesser impact downstream for orders of magnitude more people. And again, because we're in a developing region, there's a lot of people depending on healthy rivers for food and water and everything. So we, during that work, we showed, we brought in, we had a social specialist from America come in, a man called Ted Scudder, who was a well-known fighter for the social rights of people. And we were able to show that there would indeed be a large impact on the people downstream. And this was going to have a monetary sort of implication. And those people downstream were eventually awarded compensation because of what they'd lost in the way of a working river. And the money was paid out in several tranches to them over the years into trusts held by the people downstream. And they could do what they want with that money. They could, I stand to be corrected, but I think some of them used it to build roads that allowed them to get to markets and hospitals easier, you know. So they could do what they want with it. But it was, according to the World Bank, I think the first time there'd been a detailed recording of people being compensated for losing the quality of their river.
You told the story about the trees.
Yes, I can't remember the details, so I might be slightly correct here, but as far as we understand it, I know that those rivers up in Lesotho are so high up that they're essentially above the tree line. So the mountains are clear of trees, but there are trees, a few, along the edge of the river. And they are so sparse that they were owned by individual families, I believe, who could cut a branch here or there for construction, but husbanded those trees carefully because there were so few of them on the landscape.
I mean, that's such an incredible lesson somehow to see how those people had realized their relationship to the resources, the natural resources around them, that seems to have missed many people around the globe.
What we were also learning, and Lesotho helped us there, was that although the benefits of development, such as cheaper hydroelectric power or stored water for water security for cities, those benefits have been well explained for many decades by the planners and the funders, the costs that were coming up were very varied. And so it took a long time to see a pattern, because there wasn't a pattern, so to speak. And one part of that pattern, one part of the jigsaw in Lesotho, was that after Catsey Dam was built, small boys disappeared from school. And it turned out that the reason they had disappeared from school and were losing their education was because the trickle of water from Catsey Dam downstream was now insufficient to keep their livestock on one side of the river. So the livestock were moving across the river and disappearing over the mountains. And so the little boys had to stay there to herd them.
Those varied implications coming in from
all across the world of the costs of development, which we must consider. I'm not advocating stopping development. I like having water on tap and all the other things and food in the stores. But we just have to see both sides of the picture before we make the decisions.
We spoke a little earlier about one of the things I wanted to talk about a little bit was also this ongoing, it seems, balance that needs to be found between sort of flood prevention or the retention of some kind of natural structure, a biological, ecological structure, and storage and distribution of water. Mm. I mean, that is obviously something that you have been grappling with for your career.
One of the things we are learning the hard way is to try and work with nature rather than to control it, to tame it. And it costs such a lot to try and control nature. And you never completely succeed because it always has a whammy ready, which is a big flood year or something, they're learning in England at the moment, where the flooding is completely out of control. Mm. And that is decades of straightening rivers, cutting off floodplains, forcing the water downstream, building housing estates on floodplains. We do it here. Mm. I've seen housing areas built on the five-year flood line, at the five-year flood line, which means on average, river there would have flooded every 5 years. And yet they build an old age home there. I've seen those sort of things happening. Mm. And if you don't want to build there, maybe you want to use those rich soils to grow crops. And so for one reason or another, we try and force the river down a single straight channel and get it out to the sea as soon as possible. But it just doesn't work very well. And so now the move is back towards letting the river be more natural.
Just be itself.
In England, they're now turning their eyes upstream and discussing paying farmers to allow land rivers to meander and flood their land.
As the natural cycle was.
As it should have been. Centuries. And of course, once you do that, you bring back all the rich biological benefits of having a big, meandering, lazy flooding system again.
Yeah.
The floodplains will bring back all the animals and plants that we've been losing.
Mm.
Well, we've still got a lot of that intact here in Africa.
And so the floodplain.
Yes. Mm. So I've not so much in South Africa now, but further north.
Certainly Okavango.
To the Okavango, to Zambia, to Zambezi, Zimbabwe and places. They're still magnificent natural functioning rivers. And so my focus now these days is on trying to help there if I can.
Yeah. Yes, I do want to discuss some of your current work. Before that, though, I mean, you've worked on some, as you mentioned, the Okavango, which is, I've dipped my toe in the Okavango, as it were. I don't really fully understand its significance as a kind of water source floodplain for the subcontinent. But you have run a number of projects up there. Can you just give us some idea of some of that work and why the Okavango is in itself so significant?
It's a huge river system. It sources two different sources, two headwater streams in Angola. It flows down to the border of Namibia and then makes the border between the two countries. It flows across the Caprivi Strip, which people might have heard about, and then into Botswana, through between two geological faults which force it into a narrow channel called the Panhandle, and then it floods out into the Kalahari Desert.
Mm.
It essentially just pours onto
the
desert.
And that is the Okavango Swamp,
is the delta.
Delta, sorry, yeah.
It's about 15,000 kilometres. It's huge. It's the biggest oasis in the world. It's a Ramsar site. It's an international World Heritage site. And the reason it's there, well, there's two or three reasons. One is the river turns left instead of right, and so it never reaches the sea, the Atlantic Ocean. It goes inland, which means it ends up in the Kalahari Desert. Then once it comes through the Panhandle and starts to pour out onto the sand, there's another geological fault, some 100 or so kilometres, whatever it is, downstream, which lies across its path.
Right.
That holds it up. Mm. And that's why the delta spreads across the desert.
Yeah.
And then very occasionally, there's some spillage across that second geological fault, and that's where Maun is, and you get a little outlet that flows onwards towards the Makarikari Pans.
Makarikari, I've been to Makarikari.
That big geological fault is what's holding it there, and it just forms the most extraordinary oasis in the world.
Yeah. It's so, as you say, where it would naturally would have, I mean, that effect that you have in the Kalahari is essentially what would happen to that river if it hit the ocean. I mean, that's the kind of end of the river, as it were.
If it had turned right.
Yeah, if it had turned right, yeah.
It would have just poured out to sea like the Orange River and the Breda River and the Nile and all the rest.
I mean, is it one of the few rivers that does that?
There's not many that do that. I wrote in a book once about rivers that don't obey the rules.
Yeah, yeah.
And that is one of them.
Yeah.
I think there might be one or two others. I think it might be the biggest one in Africa that
doesn't go to the ocean.
That doesn't go to the ocean. Yeah,
that's. I'd never actually thought about it like that until you sort of painted that visual of how it flows. What are the sort of issues that, I mean, is that about the Angolans wanting to dam the river further upstream? Is that one of the kind of technical issues you're dealing with there? Or is it just the management in the Kalahari itself?
Those two source rivers, the Quito and the Kubanga, run through Angola. And then, as I say, they join and go past Namibia down into the delta. About 96% of the water that enters the delta comes from Angola. So at the top end, you've got the country that provides the water. At the bottom end, you have Botswana, and its second largest source of income is the tourism linked to the delta.
Yes.
So there is a tension that could develop there between a country, Angola, which most of the people in its part of the basin are very poor, and having emerged now from civil conflict, they want to develop their country and look after their people. And so the chances of transboundary conflict are high, or they were high, but there is a River Basin Commission which has been created, which serves the interests of all three countries. And over the last few years, they've come together more and more closely and are working now very closely as a unit about the future of their shared river. And they have programs called River Neighbors or our river, our water, you know.
Yeah.
They talk about sharing benefits rather than sharing water, allocating water.
So they're trying to develop a bigger picture around the river.
I mean, benefits might include, for instance, Botswana helping Angola set up a tourist industry, those sort of ideas. And we'll have to see where it goes. Where we fit into this picture is because of the new science that we've now been a part of, we've been able to bring the cost side of the discussions onto the table, along with the benefit side of building the dams and creating hydroelectric power. And so this is a system that has a chance to balance those two openly, carefully, between the member states, within the member states, between the member states and their stakeholders, and look for the best way forward. And I sense that although there are some big dams possibly looming, nothing has been decided as far as I know, and I sense the countries may be looking for a softer way forward with more localized developments. Perhaps
less impactful.
Less impactful. Mm. They're talking about terms now such as the biocapital of the basin. Mm. So you're not just talking about the capital that's invested in infrastructure such as dams, but you're talking about the biocapital that's there in terms of the value of the river system itself.
Yes, yes, yes.
And that's in terms of tourism that it brings in, and in terms of living with other species, looking after life. Just the fact that the Okavango probably makes a pretty good contribution to carbon storage through all its wetlands storing methane and everything. Mm-hmm. So they so they may be, it's playing its contribution towards
that's an almost climate. Inculcable.
Yes, towards stabilizing the climate.
Mm.
You reduce those kind of wetlands, and the wetlands, the floodplains along the Okavango system are the biggest I've ever seen.
Mm.
They are inland seas. They're enormous. Every year they fill.
Yeah.
They filter the water down into the ground, and it seeps slowly back into the system and keeps the whole system going. Yeah. It's beautiful.
That also, that whole situation seems to be a perfect example of the debate or discussion between hard and soft engineering, if I can, I can put it that way, of as you say, so engineered, hard engineered dam kind of solutions or whatever, some kind of mechanical impact on the rivers, and the soft engineering side of going back to the floodplain as the kind of self-managing system I suppose it's always been.
Yes, I mean, we've benefited from the hard engineering in many ways. The fact that we can turn on water, our taps and get water, that we can water our gardens and all of these things,
the result of infrastructure that's been imposed on them.
Of engineers getting on and doing what people demanded from them.
Mm.
And the engineers I've met and worked with don't want to damage the environment. They're trying to do their job, and if they can be helped with a way of doing it that's less impactful, they would follow that less impactful way. So we're not trying to stop engineering.
No.
We're saying let's look where we can do it in a more caring way. I mean, I remember when the Berg River Dam was built up on the near Franschhoek, here near Cape Town, and we were talking then about building a different kind of dam, which would have a huge tunnel for releasing floods down the river, something unheard of.
Mm.
And the engineers said they'd never built a dam like that before, and Water Affairs said, well, we're going
Let's
to
go
now,
for it.
And South Africa built its first river-friendly dam.
Mm.
It doesn't have no impact on the river. Just by being an obstruction across
it
the
is.
Channel, it
yeah.
will have an impact.
Mm. Mm.
But it has a lesser impact because it can release floods, help the river to go through its natural cycles.
Mm.
That's where we come to a problem, though, is because we can put the techniques in place, the science, the concepts, the technology. The implementation is something that's not our responsibility. That's the responsibility then of other people.
Mm.
And that's much more complex and difficult. And you can get failures there, even with the best will in the world
right.
in terms of the technology.
Yeah.
So implementation is difficult,
yeah.
desperately difficult.
Do you find that is your experience in your projects around the world? I mean,
yes.
it's not, yeah.
It's not, it's, yes, yes,
and,
wherever
and,
you go.
And the implementation then is really at the political level then?
It's at the political level and the managerial level, at the level of the water authorities in the countries. And so what you could find, for instance, is that a concept that has been embraced and a law that is being followed at the national level just isn't manifesting itself at the level of the dam operator in an isolated community 1,000 kilometres away, you know.
Mm.
He's not picking up on that.
Mm.
So those links can be tenuous. Some people don't want to change. Some people don't know how to change.
Mm.
It's not perhaps being taught in the universities yet to bring
just
this,
that thinking.
This combined thinking in. We still go down our silos of thinking.
Yeah.
You're an engineer or an ecologist.
Mm.
Or an economist. And so the change is happening far too slowly. I don't know. I guess training in universities more across disciplines would be a very useful point. It's happening, but not enough.
So the more multidisciplinary training.
Yes,
yeah. So to get engineers to study a bit more biology and ecology and ecologists to maybe do a little semester of engineering or something as simple as that.
Yes, I remember, you know, in our early days when we were reaching out to postgraduates in the engineering departments, I was going to engineering conferences to try and understand what they talk about, you know, sniff out the bees, so to speak, you know.
Know your enemy.
Yeah, and so, and we had very good interactions. I was scared to death of them all, but, you know, we got on okay. And
it was a very man's kind of world back then, I can imagine.
Let me tell you a story. I stood up at my first hydrological conference, and there was just a wall of suits, and I was introduced by the chair of my session in the following way. He said, "There are three great lies in life. The first great lie is I'm from head office, I'm here to help you." And they all laughed. "The second great lie is the check is in the post." And they all laughed. "And the third great lie is some of my best friends are ecologists." And they howled with laughter. And most of them left the lecture theatre.
Get out.
Yeah.
There was a visible emptying of the room.
Yes.
So that's kind of what you were. So you were not only up against a kind of political chauvinism, but also a sort of a real chauvinism.
Yeah, yes. But, you know, there was, for everyone who didn't want this to work, there
Somebody
were those
did.
Who did,
yeah.
And they were wonderful. Mm. Engineers and politicians and water managers, they were great. And the Department of Water Affairs threw its weight behind us and essentially said to those people, climb on board or get left behind.
Yeah, yeah.
And so we...
Get on
we,
the bus.
We had the country with us as we tried to make this change. Mm. It was... Only looking back do you realise how amazing it was.
Yeah.
Extraordinary.
Yeah. Another river that you've worked on that I wrote down here is the Mekong, the mighty Mekong River. And I just want you to give me a sense of that body of water. I mean, because it's hard for people to imagine what kind of body of water that is.
Oh, the Mekong. You know, I was asked on the strength of the work I'd done in Lesotho, which was linked to the World Bank. I was asked to the World Bank to go to World Water Week in Washington, several years running, where all their project managers from all around the world get together and share notes. And my talks there led to me being approached by the World Bank project manager for the Mekong to ask if I would go out there and introduce this thinking there to them, which was totally alien, not just for the Mekong, but more or less anywhere
in the
world.
For the World Bank as well.
Yes, and to the World Bank as well, yes. Mm. The Mekong starts up in the Tibetan snowfields, the glaciers, flows down through China, past a little bit of hook of Burma, which was Myanmar in those days, through between Laos and Thailand, down into Cambodia, and then down through into Vietnam and the great Mekong Delta, where a lot of the fighting went on in that civil war.
In the war,
there.
Yeah.
It's, I can't remember now. It's sort of almost 20 years since I worked there, but I worked as an advisor for the Mekong River Commission for several years and for the World Bank as an advisor before that. I think the river is about 1,500 to 2,000 kilometres long. It pours unbelievable amounts of sediment and water down into the river. And one of its most fascinating features is the Lower Mekong in Cambodia. And this is where another of my rivers that doesn't follow the rules comes in.
Okay.
Because in Cambodia, it is fed by one of its tributaries. You know, I can't even remember the name of the tributary now. Isn't it terrible? But one of its big tributaries comes in and joins it in Cambodia. Mm. Now, Cambodia is so flat that when the floods come down the Mekong, they go back up this tributary and flood all the way up it to fill in this huge lake called the Tonle Sap Lake.
My goodness.
And on the edge of the Tonle Sap Lake...
So it's like upstream flooding,
yes,
almost.
Yes, the lake increases by many, many, many times its dry season size.
Yeah.
And on the edge of the lake is Angkor Wat, one of the great ancient building sets of buildings of the world and temples, which was rediscovered by, well, they say they was discovered by the French, but of course the locals already knew they were there. And all around this great lake.
Look what we found.
All around this lake are these villages, floating villages, and they float in as the river recedes, and they float out again, and the temples float out, and the garages float out, and the restaurants float out, and they all float back in again. And as the waters pour out onto these big floodplains to make the Tonle Sap River bigger, then the fish pour out onto the floodplains and spawn. And as the floods recede in the Mekong, so the flood, it stops pushing upstream into the Tonle Sap River, that's its name, and the river turns round and flows back downstream again. So some of the year it flows one way, and the rest of the year it flows the other. And as it flows out, one of the biggest fishing industries in the world is then catching the fish that have spawned on those huge floodplains. And that is the protein source for Cambodia.
For the population.
And now the damming of the river is stopping, to some extent, to an increasing extent, the flooding of the river and the expansion of the Tonle Sap floodplain and the great fisheries. Mm. I think it's the largest inland fishery in the world on that river.
My goodness.
Yes, it's and, very sad.
And as you say, I mean, what we sometimes forget is just that the relationship between a river and the population that live on the river just goes beyond simply just water, doesn't it?
It does. There are, I think, about 60 million people living along that river. As I said, most of them are feeding themselves daily from the fish that they catch from the river. But they also have things like their riverside gardens. Each year as the floods come up, huge expanses of river flood, a riverbank flood, and then they become emerged again once the floods go. Now, these are in areas which are quite remote. They're not places where people have jobs or shops or something like that. But as the rivers recede, they plant their gardens every year and keep their food security going. You start to cut down on the floods, you start down on the viability of these riverside gardens. Mm. So, and of course they have their festival every year. When the Tonle Sap River turns, they have the big water festival. There's tourism along all of the stretches of the river, which bring in enormous amounts of money.
I can imagine. I want to discuss, if I may, the Stockholm Water Prize. And congratulations again on that.
Thank you.
And I'm just going to read a little from the citation. Dr. Jackie King is named the 2019 Stockholm Water Prize laureate for her game-changing contributions to global river management. She has advanced the scientific understanding of water flows, given decision-makers methods and tools to assess the full range of costs and benefits when managing or developing river systems. That is your life's work in a nutshell.
Yes, it is. And it's amazing, isn't it? It really is amazing.
I mean, I suppose you didn't consider the impact you might be having when those you and your few colleagues started out. But you've mentioned in Stockholm how you were kind of so inspired by the reaction of particularly young women from around the world.
Yes, I'll talk about that in a minute, but first to look at the prize itself. It is an extraordinary accolade, and I can't tell you how gratified and humble I am, and that having been recognised in this way. I was actually nominated for the prize by a woman living in Tucson, Arizona. She describes herself as a poet and activist, and she was worried about the Colorado River. She wrote to me, she saw my name in a book, she wrote to me and eventually put together the money for me to visit Colorado and Arizona, Guatemala and Costa Rica. And then we kept in touch, and I would tell her about my travels along the Mekong and the Okavango, and eventually she nominated me for this prize. 5 years in a row, I think, until they listened. And she came to with her husband to Stockholm.
Oh, magnificent.
Prize last year as my guests.
Oh, you know. Fantastic.
But the feeling at Stockholm was quite special last year, and I think there was a feeling of something turning in people wanting to look after the world better. And this was one example of how people were trying to do it. And it touched the hearts of people right across the whole of World Water Week. They said it was one of the most joyous Water Weeks that they'd ever attended, people who go there often. And I felt that too.
Mm.
And then to come down to the young women, one of the things that will always remain with me is the number of young women who approached me and said it had just given them the courage to carry on with their work. And as I said, they came from Yemen.
All over the world.
From India, from Pakistan, from South America, from different parts of Africa. And they just came and said it had helped. It had made an enormous difference. And I told you how at the closing plenary, a big, big group of them came and stood around me, just wanting to be part of us being together and feeling that we were part of a movement. And eventually we put our arms around each other in a big ring, around each other's shoulders, and bent our heads into the middle of the circle. And we all said together, just keep going, just keep going. And
incredible.
Afterwards, at another meeting, members of the German embassy here in South Africa said they were thinking of trying to get together an assembly of young women from this part of Africa in the water field. And I hope they do, because there was something very tangible there. They said they find it difficult to be heard. And I know exactly what they mean, because I also found it difficult to be heard.
Mm.
Not now, but then.
Sorry, I'm tearing up a little. I don't normally do that, quite honestly. I'm quite a stoic gentleman. But, yeah, I think, you know, it's kind of, you found yourself in a situation, I suppose, quite unanticipated of that almost reverence that you are then held in by these people who see you as such an inspiration, as an angel.
Yeah.
That they can look to for guidance and hope. Do you keep? Did you make any ongoing contact with those kids now?
Not the ones who were around me, because I didn't know most of their names. They just
they just came
there.
Up and they gave you a hug.
They just stood there and they wanted to be part of being together, which is why I hope that if we can get this Southern African
project,
meeting going, we will, you know, the German ladies who talked to me about the idea said, would I come and tell my story? I said, yes, I would, but equally important is their
stories. They must
stories.
Tell their stories.
Let them share and let us find out if there's a common thread that can help them move forward. And what I was trying to say to them was that they said, how did I get to the position I am now? And the answer is, there was no game plan. there was no road plan.
Just wing it.
There was no road plan. But what I was tending to do is the opposite of a road plan, which is I didn't know where I was going, but I knew where I wasn't going.
Hmm.
So you make decisions along the way. I don't want to do that. I don't want to do that. So I'll go that way.
Yeah.
And then I don't want to do that or that. But now an option has popped up here and I like that idea. So I'll go that way.
Hmm.
So I made various big decisions. One was to come to Africa because I'm from England.
Mm.
One was to study as a married woman when I didn't even have a matric. I was allowed into UCT as a mature,
student. Yeah.
One was to go into freshwater ecology when I didn't even have
when
a
you lived on the sea
in the field.
Yeah.
And one was to do research. And then one was to go into this field that didn't even exist then of water quantity management for river health.
Yeah.
And they, it's the, there must be a term for it in psychology. It's when you're not following a plan, you're following a plan that pushes you away from all the things you don't want to do, leaving you open for a few options which push you forward.
Well, I mean, it must...
I don't know what the name for that would be.
Well, incredible self-confidence, I think, would be one of them.
No. More of a dogged resistance to...
to fly in the face of, of the norm, I suppose.
Yes. And you don't see yourself as a... A leader.
As a pioneer or a,
I didn't.
Or
I
a mentor
didn't.
Or
a couple of times in the perhaps the in the 90s, I was shocked when I realised at a meeting that young people were seeing me as a leader when I just saw myself as a worker.
As a researcher and advisor. I mean, you've kind of, I suppose in a sense, you were an early eco-warrior, if I could dare use that term, an environmental activist in an age where that sort of term wasn't used. I'm just, I mean, I don't know if you would even recognise those.
No, I wouldn't call myself an eco-activist because one of the things I was very clear about throughout my life that I was not lobbying. I was not a lobby group. I was not trying to save the whales or anything like that. I was trying to put good, solid
information
into... I wanted to put good information in front of decision makers. As soon as you try and start to make them go one way or push them in one direction, then the quality and the confidence in the information you're giving them becomes suspect. And so some of the lobby groups would accuse me of sitting on the fence because I wouldn't back...
Their particular
mission. But I think there are two quite different roles there. One role is the person who is providing the data that both the stakeholders and the lobby groups and the governments can jointly consider. And then the other group that's important is that those stakeholders, lobby groups, whatever you want to call them, that they are powerful enough to take that information and negotiate with their governments. So it's up to them to make themselves powerful, and it's up to us to provide the information that they can use in their negotiations. And I saw them as two quite different roles. So I have become called a water warrior a couple of times since then, but I don't see myself as an eco-activist.
What is your focus? You did mention something about African rivers. I think as a consequence of your Stockholm Water Prize, you've now embarked on a new venture. Could you just tell us a little bit about
that? At the age of 76, I've tried many times to retire, and I nearly retired again last year. I walked away from my Okavango work. I retired from it. I just thought I can't keep getting on planes at my age. And the day after I got home, Stockholm phoned me and said I'd won the water prize. So I had to unretire again.
Yes, because there is some there's a money component to
this. This is one of the things, and that was that I didn't know when they told me that there's a monetary component to the prize. It's not enough money to save the world or anything, but it is enough money to act as seed money to do something. And given the publicity and the platform that this prize has given me, and then the money as well, it would be unforgivable to not try and use those for the benefit of our rivers. So I have started an initiative called Africa's Living Rivers. And the purpose of it is to try and bring ecological and social modelling and information into the very earliest stages of planning, instead of them being a reaction to decisions that were made based on economic or engineering information. Let us bring our information in right at the beginning of those discussions so that that balance of costs and benefits can be better understood before decisions are made. And so I've put it out a general call in a few conferences I've been to since I got back from Stockholm, asking if there were any SADC countries interested in having us help with one-on-one mentoring to a country team to help them bring this thinking in mm-hmm. at their earlier stages. And right. 2 weeks ago, I traveled to Zambia at the invitation of the government, and they have signed up as the first government to become to have a country team trained under the African Living Rivers Initiative.
Congratulations.
And I'm absolutely delighted.
Oh, that's magnificent.
Zambia yeah. is the ideal country. It's got beautiful rivers. It's got a lot of development on the cards, and it's got good technical skills. So the people are there, ripe and ready to work with us and bring this, not new thinking for them. They know they've got good rivers, but they didn't perhaps have the opportunity to bring it in the way that our 20 years of
experience
has allowed us to yeah. develop. So, yes, that's going to go ahead, and I hope that I'll be going to Stockholm again to World Water Week in August this year with a Zambian delegation to start looking for the extra money we need to make that happen in its totality, yes.
Oh, that's so fantastic. Yeah. Jackie, thanks so much for your time this morning. It's absolutely been a pleasure speaking to you.
Thank you. Thank you
and,
very
and
much.
And all the best with Africa's Living Rivers Project.
Thank you. Thank you.
She does love her rivers, and dare I say the mighty Mekong in particular. I'm not sure, maybe that's just because I find that immense body of water so inspiring. 60 million people living in, on, and around it. Just massive. These water systems that we take so for granted, that are all around us. I like what she said about it being impossible to tame nature, and how thinking around river management and flood control has changed in recent years. That need for sort of multidisciplinary approaches to the distribution, storage, the storage and distribution of water around the world. And I wish her all the best with her Africa's Living Rivers organization. That was such a beautiful thing she's done. Remember also, please become a patron, keep the project alive. With your support, the podcast can travel to all corners of South Africa and beyond, which would be pretty cool. Thanks again to Hindenburg for their support. Hindenburg software is designed for radio journalism and podcasting and is practical and easy to use. Go to hindenburg.com for more information and sign up for a free trial. You may subscribe to Voices from SA via Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Radio Public, Deezer, or indeed wherever you get your podcasts. Tell your colleagues, tell your friends, tell the world. Until next time, I'm Nicholas Claude. Cheers.